Hey, hi everyone. It's Deborah. Definitely not Doug. And I don't see Doug on the list, but, you know, his name was on here before. Let me just pull up the list here. Okay, Doug's coming in. I just see him flashing up here now. So, in a minute, I'm going to pass this. In less than a minute, I'm going to pass this mic over. Doug, can you hear me yet? I don't see you in the room yet. Okay, he's not in the room. Anyways, good afternoon. It's good to see everybody here again. And Doug has just arrived. So, Doug, you can take the mic. It's yours.
Hi, thank you, Deborah. I have been trying, as I do every week, to get everything set up, including making a recording and using all the equipment and settings that worked last week. I can't get anything to work right now, which is why I'm a little late and attempting to get something recording here while I'm talking to you. I really need a technician. And so, Deborah, I'm going to let you make your introductions right now. Well, give me a minute to see if I can get this stuff working, okay?
Well, my introductions are always very short. Doug, I see where you posted on the board that I am here. Oh, Doug. Okay, so I think my Dove sounds like Doug sometimes. My Doug sounds like Dove sometimes. Sometimes the Doug I say is Dove rather than Doug. So aim to really confuse, right? Sorry about that. I trip over those two all the time for some reason. Dove, when Doug is on, wants to come out. So it's just that trippy little name. The names are so close together. So I don't know how long Doug is planning on taking here, but I thought, okay, you're ready already? Oh, my gosh. Okay, here you go.
Yes, thanks. I was just waiting for the laptop to reboot, and it's now recording. And I spent the last 20 minutes trying to make it record unsuccessfully, and it just needed rebooting. Something in its memory got lost or something. Anyway, so we're here, everybody, and welcome all to our Sunday afternoon study of the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. My name is Doug Thompson, as most of you already know, and my co-host is Deborah Maltman. And I usually like to start these sessions by asking everyone to remember what Jesus said, "Wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, there also shall I be." And to take a moment to remember why we're here studying his words, and remember that he is here with us, and the understanding of the material that he wants us to have really comes from him. These words are but tools to focus our attention on the reality that he's talking about. Now, I think that's all I want to say about that. And for those who are here for the first time, I usually provide a bit of background on what we're doing here, because it can be a bit confusing otherwise. And for those who already know this part, you can take a couple of minutes break. As most of you know, the Course exists in a number of versions as a result of extensive editing and abridgment over the years. While anyone looking at the earliest raw handwritten form will recognize that some parts certainly needed editing, some of the editing ended up blurring and obscuring points which were originally somewhat clearer. In fact, some of the most important teachings in the early part of the Course simply vanished along. So one reason for studying this material is it gives us a clearer picture not only of what Jesus originally said, but in his sidebar explanations to Helen and Bill, what he really meant. The earliest written record of A Course in Miracles is found in two collections of Helen Schuckman's manuscripts, her original shorthand notes and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. I'm frequently asked about other versions of the Course, which are also advertised or labeled as in some way original. There are actually six different versions of the text of the Course of which I am aware, and five for which I've been able to obtain copies. From the longest to the shortest, they vary in length by some 50,000 words. Most of these have been published, and in most cases, the publisher claims each is in some way original. This inevitably generates confusion. So what we're working with today is original in the sense of being what was originally written down by Helen Schuckman before the editing process began. What I've been doing for the past few months is going through these two earliest manuscripts, the notes and the Urtext, and combining them, because while the Urtext is very similar to the notes, there was some material left out. Most of that was, I would say, I think anybody would say, was properly left out, because it wasn't intended to be part of the Course. It includes such things as Helen's dream diaries. In other cases, some of the material that was removed was almost certainly removed inadvertently and did belong. But even that which was taken out appropriately is still interesting and gives us a better idea of the context within which Helen and Bill were having this experience of receiving the dictation. So, without further ado, I'm going to point out that the document we're going to be reading from today is available on the net if you want to follow along with us. And Deborah, do you have that URL handy? If not, I do here. Copy. Okay, at that URL that I just posted, and if the radio is working, it wasn't earlier. For those on the radio, you can go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74 and click on original dictation, and that will display the document we're going to be reading from. The basic format we use is reading and commentary plus discussion. There tends to be a lot more commentary and discussion than reading sometimes. While I'd encourage everyone to raise your hand if you have something to share, I'd also appreciate it if you try to keep your comments focused on the topic and try to keep it under 3 minutes unless something truly exceptional arises, which sometimes happens. Deborah will be keeping an eye on the hands on the board, and she's our moderator here. When she acknowledges your hand and drops the mic, then you can pick it up. Now, usually towards the end, I try to do a summary. Sometimes we don't get that far. But if you have along the way, either raise your hand to take the mic or type them in the board if you don't have a mic available. Now, that brings us to where we're going to start our reading today, and I want to make a few comments about what we've been reading really since February when we began this 25,000 word chapter one of the original dictation. I'll point out that in the foundation version, those 25,000 words are reduced to 5,500. And most of what's missing is what's the second part of what Jesus originally dictated. After the miracle principles, there is a very lengthy discussion of the distortion of miracle impulses and the relationship between the miracle impulse and the sexual impulse. And these two parts, I think, are like two sides of one coin, and they're not really properly separated, because in order to understand what miracles are, we need to be told, in order to understand how to be a miracle worker, we need to understand not just the objective of the miracle, but also the obstacles, the psychological and spiritual obstacles that have to be overcome before those miracles can be manifest. Mostly what got somehow or other, what disappeared through the editing process. And having finished those discussions, which really takes us to what's Chapter 2C, that's using the HLC chapter and section designations. Having finished that discussion, we now, that section, the new section begins. The new emphasis will now be on healing. And with that understanding of what miracles are and the various obstacles or distortions of miracle impulses that can steer us off, the focus is now going to be on healing, and that's where our reading is going to begin today. Last week we ended off, we did the first 10 paragraphs of Section 2C, and I'm going to suggest we reread that today to get everybody's mind back into the flow of, into the train of thought. And I'm not going to offer much discussion on these first 10 because we did go over them last week. But if anybody has questions, by all means, raise your hand. And Deborah, here's the mic.
Okay. Can everybody hear me right now? Or can any? Yep. Okay. Thanks. And Dove, if you're still in here again, I wanted to ask you more on this station identification thing, because it seems to me that it could be that there's a lot of opportunity missing for letting people know about what you have going on here. If someone is listening to audio tapes and they're not played in Gather, it's not necessarily going to give the listener where this is all taken place. So maybe it is a good idea that a station identification is mentioned at least once per session that is being taped. There's a lot of sessions being taped here at Gather, and really, if a person doesn't know about Gather, and not, even if they do, it's not necessarily going to mean that the audio tape that they're listening to was taking place in Gather. So if you're listening to that, it's something that you might want to consider. Session identification, we're at ACIM Gather Radio, and ACIM Gather Room, we're in the room at Pal Talk Scene, if anyone wants to join that's listening out there and doesn't know about the room. And it generates through One Mind Foundation, if I get that correct. That could be erroneous on my part. So hi again, everyone, and hi, everyone who didn't get my hi as has come into the room since. I will just be very brief and give the usual opening prayer that I like to offer up because of it, something that Jesus would like us to say every day, and that is to help me perform whatever miracles you want of me today. And if you will tell me what to do, only that I will to do. That's for miracle workers. And the only prayer we ever really need to give is, Lord, heal me, which was in the ear text. So amen. And Doug, the mic is all yours.
Okay. Actually, the mic is all yours. T2C1, and I'm not sure why you're... I should have mentioned this to you before. I see it the last few weeks. You're putting a CTRL in front of the paragraph ID. I'm not quite sure why. But for those who are following along on the online copy, if you want to find the paragraph we're on, if you lose your place, every paragraph is labeled with in Chapter 2, 2 in Section C, C, and then 1, 2, 3, 4 for the paragraphs. And in the browser, you can get to any paragraph with a Control F to open up your browser search box. I think all browsers use Control F for that. And then T space 2 space C space 1 return will generally get you right to that paragraph. And so we'll be announcing the paragraph we're on from time to time. Also, I want to point out for those looking at the online version, that when you come to bold italic type, that's material that came from the shorthand notes that's not in the ur text. As I mentioned before, the ur text and the shorthand notes are mostly very similar, and some of the material that's left out appears actually to have been a copying mistake, especially if it's a small amount, though in other cases there may be other explanations. Anyway, Deborah, T2C1, healing as release from fear. Here's the mic.
Well, the CTRL was the one that was what you had told people to click on, was it not, to access the right passage, if they could access it very easily that way? Did I get that wrong somehow, Doug? CTRLF. I thought you could just put the number, the text, and whatever. And, oh, Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, I'll explain that again because obviously it didn't get understood. On the online copy, if you want to find a paragraph reference, most browsers, I believe all browsers, with a control F, a search box or a find box will open, and then you can type a string, and when you hit return, if that string is found, it will be, your browser will scroll to that spot. And the string in question would be a paragraph reference, because it's not going to be mixed up with anything else, such as T space 2 space C space 1. So the sequence would be control F, then you type that string, and in Firefox it'll just go to it. You don't have to hit return. In some other browsers you have to hit return after you enter the string. Control F and type T2C1, and possibly you will have to type a return at the end of that. It can be useful if you want to follow along and you lose your place. It's a very quick way to get to a spot in the document. So, Deborah, back to you for reading Healing as a Release from Fear, T2C1.
The new emphasis will now be on healing. The miracle is the means, the atonement the principle, and the healing is the result. Those who speak of the miracle of healing are combining two orders of reality inappropriately. Healing is not a miracle. The atonement, or the final miracle, is extremely useful. It is purely a means, while any type of healing is a result. As we noted yesterday, the atonement is the remedy. The order of error to which atonement is applied is irrelevant. Essentially, all healing is the release from fear. But to undertake this, you cannot be fearful yourself. Doug.
Yes, the atonement is the remedy. The remedy for what? Well, it's the remedy for the separation. That's what came in the previous section. So the problem that we're addressing here is the separation. The atonement is the remedy. The separation is caused by a number of distortions of miracle principles. And atonement consists of the undoing of those distortions so that our missed thought ends up being corrected. All healing is a release from fear, and fear is the cause of distortions of miracle impulses. But to undertake this, you cannot be fearful yourself. This is also very important to remember about miracle-mindedness. Where there is fear, that blocks, fear tends to block our spiritual eye, our spiritual vision. We can't see the truth, the reality, the love of God when we are fearful. Okay, so that's basically the frame, the conceptual framework within which this next part fits. Deborah.
You do not understand healing because of your own fear. I have been hinting throughout, parentheses, and once stated very directly, because you were unfearful at the time, close parenthesis, that you must heal others. The reason is that their healing merely witnesses or attests to yours. A major step in the atonement is a plan. In the atonement plan is to undo error. Start that again. A major step in the atonement plan is to undo error at all levels. Illness, which is really not right-mindedness, is the result of level confusion in the sense that it always entails the misbelief that what is amiss in one level can adversely affect another. Doug.
Okay, that statement I think is very important, and I also think that there's an error in it, which will become clear in subsequent paragraphs. The level confusion, the levels being talked about here are the physical level versus the spiritual level. And the misbelief that what is amiss in one level can adversely affect another, I believe, is supposed to be what is amiss at the spirit, at the physical level can adversely affect the spiritual level. Because we go on to spiritual also would be equivalent to mind in the language being used here. Because Jesus goes on to explain that all problems start in the mind and all bodily ailments come from mental or spiritual causes, ultimately, misbeliefs. So what is amiss at the level of mind can certainly affect the body, but what's amiss at the level of the physical cannot affect the mind necessarily, unless we believe it can. That's the essential point being made here, that the belief that the physical can affect the mind and have genuine creative causation is the single mistake, core mistake that Jesus is getting at. And the idea is that the mind is the only level at which cause can occur, and the physical level is reflective or symptomatic of what's going on in the mind. So the mental level can certainly affect the physical, but the physical can't affect the mental except through the agency of our misbelief. If we believe it can, it will, in our experience. Okay, so this brings us to T2C5. Deborah.
We have constantly referred to miracles as a means of correcting level confusion. In reality, all mistakes must be corrected at the level at which they occur. Only the mind is capable of error. The body can act erroneously, but this is only because it has responded to misthought. The body cannot create, and the belief that it can, a fundamental error responsible for most of the fallacies already referred to, produces all physical symptoms. All physical illness represents a belief in magic. The whole distortion which created magic rested on the belief that there is a creative ability in matter which can control the mind. This fallacy can work either way, i.e., it can be misbelieved either that the mind can miscreate in the body or that the mind can miscreate in the mind. If it can be made clear that the mind, which is the only level of creation, cannot create beyond itself, then neither confusion need occur. Doug.
Okay. As Jackson noted, that was, there was a misreading there. The statement, and it's a very important one, the fallacy in the middle of paragraph T2C6, this fallacy can work either way, i.e., it can be misbelieved either that the mind can miscreate in the body or that the body can miscreate in the mind. If it can be made clear that the mind, which is the only level of creation, cannot create beyond itself, then neither confusion need occur. So, let's just review this paragraph because it's so important and foundational to everything that follows. Jesus is telling us here that all physical illness represents a belief in magic. So the physical illness essentially is manifesting the beliefs we have in our mind. The whole distortion which created magic rested on the belief that there is a creative ability in matter which of the mind. Okay? The whole distortion which created the magic or the belief in magic rested on the belief that there is a creative ability in matter which can control the mind. Whenever we read that term magic thinking elsewhere in the course, this is the definition of it. It's the magic thinking is the belief that there is a creative ability in matter which can control the mind. And it implies that there's a lack of belief that the mind is the only level of creation which cannot create beyond itself. So there's a series of beliefs which I think all of us have. Our civilization at its current level of evolution really believes in magic of all kinds and that there is a creative ability in matter. And it's very difficult to step outside that belief into miracle-mindedness. But that's what the Course is trying to show us how to do by contrasting the two thought systems. The distorted system, the magic thinking, which causes the separation. I mean, that is the separation illusion is a result of all those misbeliefs. To contrast those with the truth so that we can learn to recognize one from the other, because we can't really choose between them until we know what they are. And once we know what they are and learn how to choose, then we realize there's only one choice. I mean, the right choice is always the choice we make when we can tell which one's right, isn't it? So, I'm looking at the board here and I'm not quite sure what's being asked. Yeah, Deborah, you did actually, you said the mind cannot create in the mind instead of the body, or you said that the mind can miscreate in the mind. And actually what the text says is that the body can miscreate in the mind. That's the belief there. So I'm just going to read that sentence again. It's in the middle of T2C6. The fallacy, which is the whole idea that there's a creative ability in matter, can work either way. It can be misbelieved either that the mind can miscreate in the body or that the body can miscreate in the mind. Okay? Now, on to T2C7. Deborah, here you go.
Okay, Lee, you have a question on here. So did you want to take the mic to ask the question? Because I'm not at all sure what your question is. You don't have any question? Oh, you don't have a mic either. Okay, it looked like it on the board. All right, so I'm going to carry on here. T2C7, right. See if I can read it right. The reason why only the mind can create is more obvious than may be immediately apparent. The soul has been created. The body is a learning device for the mind. Learning devices are not lessons in themselves. Their purpose is merely to facilitate the thinking of the learner. The most that a faulty use of a learning device can do is to fail to facilitate. It does not have the power in itself to introduce actual learning errors. The body, if properly understood, shares the invulnerability of the atonement to two-edged application. This is not because the body is a miracle, but because it is not inherently open to misperception or misinterpretation. I'll read that sentence again. This is not because the body is a miracle, but because it is not inherently open to misinterpretation. The body is merely a fact. Its abilities can be, and frequently are, over-evaluated. However, it is almost impossible by its existence. Those who do are engaging in a particularly unworthy form of denial. Parentheses, the use of the word unworthy here implies simply that it is not necessary to protect the mind by denying the unmindful. There is little doubt that the mind can miscreate. If one denies this unfortunate aspect of its power, one is also denying the power itself. Close parenthesis. Doug.
Okay, there's some interesting comments on the board here. The ideas here are extremely interesting, and Lee has been pointing this out in her typing, that trying to summarize this is really an incredibly important little section. And perhaps it's just worth rereading this last paragraph again and focusing very closely on what's being said. The body, if properly understood, shares the invulnerability of the atonement to two-edged application. If properly understood, and what is the invulnerability of the atonement to two-edged application? The atonement or undoing error can't hurt anybody or anything. Unlike other defenses, which are two-edged swords and can turn around and bite us, the atonement or undoing of mistakes can never cause a problem. So the body, if properly understood, shares that invulnerability of the atonement to two-edged application. This is not because the body is a miracle, but because it is not inherently open to misinterpretation. The body is merely a fact. Its abilities can be, and frequently are, over-evaluated. However, it is almost impossible to deny its existence. Those who do so are engaging in a particularly unworthy form of denial. The word unworthy here implies simply that it's not necessary to protect the mind by denying the unmindful, or by denying the body. There is little doubt that the mind can miscreate. If one denies this unfortunate aspect of its power to miscreate, one is also denying the power itself. So the body is simply a fact, and it is not a creative entity. It simply responds to what the mind tells it to do. The body can act erroneously, back in T2C5, but this is only because it has responded to a misthought. Again, reading the end of T2C5. The body cannot create, and the belief that it can, a fundamental error responsible for most of the fallacies already referred to, produces all physical symptoms. Okay, so it's the belief that the body has some creative power in itself that produces physical symptoms. That's what we're being told. Agree with it or not, that's what Jesus is saying here. It is that belief, then, which is also the belief in magic, which is the subject of the atonement. The atonement is the remedy for that belief, and that belief is also inherent in, or an implant, the belief in separation, that the body is somehow separate on its own and not essentially subject to the mind. But the body should not be denied. It's a fact, and in itself a neutral fact, which takes us to the end of T2C8. The body is a teaching device or a communication device. The only function of the body, we're told elsewhere, is as a tool for communication. Yeah, that's its proper use. That's why we have it, in order to communicate. And it's like all teaching tools, it's just a tool. It's not a creative force in its own right. And it has no creative powers independent from the mind. Yet, we believe the opposite. Otherwise, we wouldn't get sick. Otherwise, we wouldn't run to the doctor. Because we're still fearful that the body does have this power. And when we're fearful, miracles aren't working for us. So T2C9 goes on to explain this further. And Deborah will read that now, please.
All miracles seem, no, start again. All miracles means, all, oh my gosh, all right, I'm just taking an eye break from the paper here. I'm taking a sip of water. And I will start again at T2C9. All material means, which man accepts as remedies for bodily ills, are simply restatements of magic principles. It was the first level of error to believe that the body created its own illness. Thereafter, it is a good second misstep to attempt to heal it through non-creative agents. Not good. It is a second misstep to attempt to heal it through non-creative agents. It does not follow, however, that the application of these very weak corrective devices is evil. Sometimes the illness has sufficiently great a hold over an individual's mind to render him inaccessible to atonement. In this case, one may be wise to utilize a compromise approach to mind and body, in which something from the outside is temporarily given healing belief. This is because the last thing that can help the non-right-minded, in parentheses, or the sick, is an increase in fear. They are already in a fear-weakened state. If they are inappropriately exposed to a straight and miracle, they may be precipitated into panic. This is particularly likely to occur when upside-down perception has introduced the belief that miracles are frightening. Doug.
Okay, so having talked about bodies and minds and causation and creativity, Jesus then adds this sort of caveat that there's nothing evil or wrong with magic, necessarily. And when the mind is fearful of miracles, and upside-down perception can induce the belief that miracles are frightening, then the miracle healing would only increase fear and would be the last thing that could help the non-right-minded or the sick. In that case, giving him an aspirin for his headache would be the only thing that's not going to make him fearful, the only thing that will actually be helpful. Yes, Jackson writes, wow, powerful concept, upside-down thinking to be fearful of miracles. Well, that's the last line in time. Upside-down perception can induce the belief that miracles are frightening, can and often does. When our perception is mistaken, we think that miracles are frightening, and that renders our minds inaccessible to atonement or the undoing, because the fear defenses, the ego defenses, of fear. Fear is almost always fear for the body. End up making miracles look frightening. And Jackson also writes, it's okay to use magic when fear is too great to see miracles. When fear is too great to see miracles as non-frightening, yeah. Okay, so this brings us to T2C10. And Deborah, here's the mic.
The value of atonement does not lie in the manner in which it is expressed. In fact, if it is truly used, it will inevitably be expressed in whatever way it is most helpful to the receiver, not the giver. This means that a miracle, to attain its full efficacy, must be expressed in a language which the recipient can understand without fear. It does not follow by any means that this is the highest level of communication of which he is capable, but it does mean that it is the highest level of communication of which he is capable now. Doug.
This is another hugely important concept in relation to magic thinking and atonement. The undoing or atonement, if it is truly used, will inevitably be expressed in whatever way is most helpful to the receiver, not the giver, which is a very interesting comment. The object of the healing is for the one who's on the receiving end of it. So that this means that a miracle, to attain its full efficacy, must be expressed in a language which the recipient can understand without fear. And that means that a true miracle, or a miracle truly used, will always do just that. It will be expressed in a language which the recipient can understand without fear, and it will never, this is said elsewhere, not in this paragraph, but it's an implied inference, logical inference from this statement, that the miracle will never do anything that increases fear. And that means that if one is afraid of a miracle, if the miracle would induce fear, magic is all that's left as a healing agent. And this does not follow, or it does not follow from that, by any means, that this is the highest level of communication of which the person being healed is capable, but it does mean that it's the highest level of communication of which he is capable now, in the moment. And of course, the whole aim of the miracle is to raise the level of communication, which we'll get into in the next paragraph, T2C11. Deborah.
The whole aim of the miracle is to raise the level of communication, not to impose regression, in parentheses, as improperly used, upon it, before it is safe to let miracle workers loose in this world. I really laugh at that line. It is essential that they understand fully the fear of release. Otherwise, they may unwittingly foster the misbelief that release is imprisonment, which is very prevalent. This misperception arose from the attempted protection advice or device. This misperception arose from the attempted protection device, in parentheses, or misdefense, that harm can be limited to the body. This was because of the much greater fear, in parentheses, which this one counteracts, that the mind can hurt. Neither error is really meaningful because the miscreations of the mind do not really exist. That recognition is a far better protection device than any form of level confusion because of the advantages of introducing correction at the level of the error. Doug.
Lee writes, aha, back to the beginning. Yes, this brings this segment is a piece. And it's really interesting, that line. Before it's safe to let miracle workers loose in this world, it's essential that they understand fully the fear of release. The fear of release results from the fact that we created our prison with our various illusions and distortions and fallacies so that we believe everything's upside down. But we do believe it. Well, most of us tend to believe it. And therefore, we're afraid of letting go this prison, which to us is home and everything we know and offers us safety. And without understanding the depth of the fear of release, the idea can be fostered unwittingly that release is imprisonment, an idea which Jesus says is very prevalent. The recognition of the fear of release is a far better protection device than any form of level confusion about mind and body level confusion, because the advantages of introducing correction at the level of error. And the level of the error is the belief that release is fearful. And when we recognize that, we can be safely let loose in the world as miracle workers. And without the recognition of that, it's not safe to let us loose as miracle workers. Which brings us to T2C12. Deborah.
It is essential that the remembrance of the fact that only mind can create at all remain with you. Implicit in this is the corollary that correction belongs at the thought level and not at either level to which creation is inapplicable. To repeat an earlier statement and also to extend it somewhat, the soul is already perfect and therefore does not require correction. The body does not really exist, except as a learning device for the mind. This learning device is not subject to errors of its own because it was created, but is not creating. It should be obvious, then, that correcting the creator, in parentheses, or inducing it to give up miscreation, is the only application of creation which is inherently meaningful at all. We said before, magic is essentially mindless, or the destruction, in parentheses, miscreated, use of mind. Physical medicines are a form of spells. In one way, they are a more benign form in that they do not entail the possession fallacy, which does enter when a mind believes that it can possess another. Since this is considerably less dangerous, though still incorrect, it has its advantages. It is particularly helpful to the therapist who really wants to heal, but is still fearful himself. By using physical means to do so, he is not engaging in any form of enslavement, even though he is not applying the atonement. This means that his mind is dulled by fear, but it is not actively engaged in distortion. Doug.
Okay, this comes back to the linkage between magic and fear and the neutrality of magic. So when too fearful to use a miracle, when the mind is dulled by fear, but the urge to be helpful is intact, then healing by physical means is not an act of distortion. It's essentially, again, neutral. And by implication, necessary when fear is substantial and present, particularly when fear is present in the mind of the healer. Okay. That brings us to T2C13. No, you did. We just read that one. Sorry, I'm scrolling here. T14. Deborah.
Those who are afraid of using the mind to heal are right in avoiding it, because the very fact that they are afraid has made them vulnerable to miscreation. They are therefore likely to misunderstand any healing they might induce, and, because egocentricity and fear usually occur together, may be unable to accept the real source of the healing. Under these conditions, it is safer for them to rely temporarily on physical healing devices because they cannot misperceive them as their own creations. As long as their own vulnerability persists, it is essential to preserve them from even attempting miracles. We said in the previous section that the miracle is an expression of miracle-mindedness. Miracle-mindedness merely means right-mindedness in the sense that we are now using it. Right-mindedness neither exalts nor depreciates the mind of the miracle worker nor of the miracle receiver. However, as a creative act, the miracle need not await the right-mindedness of the receiver. In fact, its purpose is to restore him to his right mind. But it is essential that the miracle work in his right mind, or he will be unable to reestablish right-mindedness in someone else. Doug.
This is remarkable material. One of the more common questions that comes up among Course students sometimes is, why aren't we seeing miracles? Why is this problem not getting a miraculous solution? Why am I sick? Why is my friend sick? Why can't I raise the dead like Jesus did? And we're just being told here exactly why. Along with, when we're not fully right-minded, it is safer to rely temporarily on physical healing devices rather than even attempting miracles, because the miracle could be misunderstood, cause fear, or contribute to egocentricity. And I think myself, that's an explanation right there as to when we think we want a miracle and we're not seeing one, a lack of right-mindedness. The atonement, you know, somewhere else it says your only responsibility is to accept the atonement for yourself, to accept the undoing of your own errors, misperceptions, distortions, etc., which undoing results in right-mindedness, which is miracle-mindedness. So the real key here to understanding the miraculous is to understand the undoing of the distortions and fallacies that result in wrong-mindedness and miscreation. And when our errors of perception and our misbeliefs are corrected, the result is right-mindedness and miracle-mindedness, at which point magic would have no role. But until that is achieved, temporarily, magic is necessary. Okay, now, I haven't been reading the board here. Deborah, you have, so if you want to comment on that before we go into T2C16, I'm going to look at it now. Here's the mic.
Now, how did you know that I had a question on this, Doug? Everybody's reading my mind today. It's pretty interesting. I have a question about, I'm trying to get a stronger grasp on where the magic is most commonly used, or maybe even just examples and in reality examples of where we're using this magic. So again, I will learn Eileen to autism people, or maybe even Alzheimer's, something where people are really, they can't even relate to this world. We don't really know what world they're relating to, but I highly unlikely think it's the real world. So in that case, they are really out of their right mind, and they would not be able to relate to anything that we communicate with them. Magic is applied there. So am I on the right stream here? Wherever my thinking is today, I'm needing help with getting this sorted out. So I'm going to pass the mic back to you, Doug.
I am not exactly sure what you're asking. Can you try to say that again? Because I don't know what you're asking, so I don't know what to say.
I don't know. This is, I'm not sure if I'm clear in this myself. We're looking at the use of magic with minds that cannot, that it's too fearful for them to accept healing or a miracle. So we're going to use magic in that, or as, okay, this is good because I'm coming up with another question, or as a miracle worker, it's actually the miracle worker. If we are unclear, we're using magic. So, okay, I think I just answered this. It's my own unclarity as a miracle worker as to whether I use magic or not, whether magic is used or not. Yes, right on, Deborah, this is even for a headache, right. Okay, but even for someone that's external to me, I mean, of course, I mean, I'm going to be using it on myself, but I'm also going to be using it for other people, possibly. So it's that two-way street. And I still have some question in here. I still have something that's not at peace, but I can't peg. I guess I'll just let it go for now. Did you want the mic back now, Doug?
Okay, I'm just going to read some of the comments on the board, which I've been trying to read. And one reason I often don't, folks, is because I'm trying to pay attention to what I'm hearing and or my eyes are on the text. And I'm really trying to focus on exactly what's being said. And it's difficult for me to do that and read the board reasonably at the same time. But there's some very good comments here from Jackson. Prescription drugs are way overused. However, that doesn't mean that sometimes they can't be direct, be indirect. Doesn't mean that sometimes they, I think you mean can't be indirectly helpful. Well, yes. I think that's exactly what we're being said here. Any physical means of healing, which would include, I would say, right down to, putting a band-aid on a cut, that's a physics for healing. There's other ways to heal. There's miracles. But if the miracle isn't happening, there's nothing wrong with using these weak physical means, which would include drugs. Jackson also writes, the miracle only happens in the mind of the sick one. The supposed miracle worker is merely allowing a place of safety for miracles to happen. I think that's pretty true. And that the miracle worker is something of a conduit, with the miracle coming from the Holy Spirit at Jesus' direction through us. As we go back to the first line of the course, you will see miracles through your hands, through me. There is a... a hand-to-hand-to-hand passing here from the Holy Spirit through the Christ as manifested in Jesus through us via Christ guidance to, through us, through the miracle worker, to the miracle receiver. A flow of divine love, and the miracle worker must be able to create a space of safety in his own mind for to be a conduit. And the person holding the light in right-mindedness is merely creating a space for the miracle to happen in the mind of the, in the mind of the sick. Yeah, I think that there's that's pretty much what's going on. Okay, miracles from Holy Spirit to sick ego-minded one. There is an allowing from the receiver. Yes, I mean, to receive a miracle, miracles can't be imposed on people, I don't think. And I look at these stories in the Bible, in the New Testament, about Jesus performing miracles, and so often after there's a story of a miracle healing, he says something like, your faith has made you well. That the person on the receiving end has to open the door, and a miracle worker then has the function of essentially being the courier to pass the love of God to the person who's open to it, at which point there is a restoration of wholeness. Your faith has restored you, Lee writes. Yeah, that's that comment is so frequent in the miracle stories that I think it's got to have some historical basis, or it wouldn't show up so often in so many different specific stories and contexts. And it also reminds me what Adele just wrote here. When the patient is ready to be healed, a comment made by Eric Berne on transactional analysis I read back in 1970 or 71. And it was a profound comment to me, and that I remember very clearly. It had a huge impact on me. And he was a practicing psychiatrist, and he said that it suddenly dawned on him one day when trying to figure out what therapies worked for whom and when, being a responsible healer who really did want to help his patients, he was trying to find the right magic to apply that would do the job. And suddenly he woke up one day and realized the patients who get well are those who have decided to get well. And once they decide to get well, it doesn't matter what I do. They get well. And until they decide to get well, it doesn't matter what I do. They don't. Yeah, David, it is to some extent closely related to the placebo effect. The belief or the decision to get well result has the result of the patient gets well. And I suppose that also means that the fear of release has diminished, so the patient is willing to be released from his illness and has made that decision to receive healing, at which point, you know, whether it's this doctor or that doctor or his mother-in-law, he's able to receive it, and it comes to him, and he is well. And until he has made the decision to let go of the illness, or the decision to get well, as Berne put it, he's going to stay sick. You know, we might cure his symptoms with drugs and medicines and various physical means, but we're not going to cure the cause or remedy the cause. So this is potent stuff, this healing stuff. Now, I am trying to read the board here, and you cannot be healed from the manual for teachers. You cannot be healed unless you recognize why you want to be sick. Yeah, that's just the idea. The healing, well, why you want to be sick would be the fallacy that the atonement came, was created to undo. When the misthought that I want to be sick or that sickness will be good for me is remedied, by the atonement, when that thought is undone, right-mindedness sets in, and so do miracles, and so does wellness. Okay. Deborah, I'm going to pass you back the microphone here, and if anybody feels like they would like to add something to this discussion, you can put up your hand and we'll pass you the mic. Deb, here you go.
We have a sickness agenda. Carmen, you had your hand up. Oh, Carmen, where did Carmen leave to? There you are. I see your hand. I see your name. You had your hand up a couple minutes ago. Did you still want the mic? Here you go.
Hi, can you hear me? I can't see if anybody can hear me. Yes, thank you. Okay, this is just a small point, but to me it's been a very pivotal one and a kind of a helpful one. Doug brought up what is in the New Testament in so many different places where we read in English that Jesus says to people, your faith has healed you. And one of the things that I have read from scholars is that that's kind of a bad translation of what he actually said. It's closer to modern usage anyway. The connotation of the word that was used in English today would better be trust. In other words, your trust has healed you instead of your faith. To me, there's a difference in degree between trust and faith. Faith establishes a certain level of commitment, that trust is just a momentary thing. And I think it's kind of a crucial thing also because of the emphasis in the manual for teachers on the word trust, on the concept of trust being the basis of all of the characteristics of a teacher in trusting the love of God, trusting the goodness of God. And so when I read the New Testament where I see Jesus saying, your faith has healed you, instead I read in my mind, trust has healed you instead of your faith has healed you. It opens up the door for healing to people who haven't established it as faith, but who are simply willing for an instant to see a better way. And that again goes in with what the manual, I believe, says that the healer or the teacher of God, the miracle worker, simply suggests that there's a better way to the patient, to the sick person. And it's, you know, it doesn't even have to be verbalized. It can simply be in the mind that there is a better way than trusting to magic. In other words, what Deborah was talking about, the Alzheimer's and the autism, everybody's trying to find the physical cause. They're trying to find the magical cause so that they can find a magical bullet to heal the matter, when in truth that's magical thinking. It's the wrong approach. It's symptom treatment. It's the belief that there is a power in matter that mind cannot overcome, when it's in truth the reverse. And if we can just trust that idea for just an instant, that mind is more powerful than matter, that mind actually shapes matter, then we see miracles happen. Just from that momentary trust, that holy instant of saying, there may be a better way and I'm willing to give it a try just this once. And you start to see the results of that trust for a moment, and you start to have those moments more closely together, and they last longer. And that's when we get to the state of faith, and we go beyond faith to belief and then knowing. And I love you guys, and thank you for letting me have this moment. I'm sorry I went on so long.
Well, thank you, Carmen. That was very useful. And that word faith, and the way it is used in most English translations of the Bible, has caused millions of people a great deal of head scratching. If you had faith as big as a mustard seed, you could say to that mountain, get up and move, and it will. And people wonder why doesn't the mountain move when I say so? So I must have no faith. Where do I get it? What is it? How can I come upon this faith that I don't have? Faith is also said in the Course to be a gift of God. it comes from God, it can be considered along with the word belief and with the word trust. We trust in that in which we have faith. And we can have faith in evil. We can believe that someone is evil. We can have that belief. We can trust that it's true. We can have faith in our belief, and it will tend to result in our experiencing that person as evil, whether or not he is. And of course, inherently no one is. So the faith or trust that needs to be present for the miracle is the faith in truth rather than falsehood, in right-mindedness rather than wrong-mindedness, in reality rather than the various distortions and delusions and illusions about reality that have themselves created the belief in separation, which belief, of course, results in our having the experience of separation. And the experience seems to cause the belief, but in fact, it's the other way around. Jackson writes, faith in the laws of chaos is still faith. Absolutely. You can have, you know, you can have faith that the world is flat. There are some people who do. But the faith or belief or trust that is required for miracle-mindedness is the faith or belief or trust in the truth, not in the distortion or the fallacy or the illusion. Absolutely central in terms of understanding the, what you might call the social function of miracles, how and when they will happen in our experience is how and is when we, if even for a moment, step into right-mindedness and trust the truth is going to work better than the falsehood. At that moment, it does. And until that moment, it won't, because our mind is essentially blocking it, the enormous power of our own beliefs. Okay, now, this brings us to, I believe, T2C16 would be where we will pick up again. Ah, Deborah, here you go.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Carmen, for your input there as well. That was beneficial. T2C16, the healer who relies on his own readiness is endangering. He is perfectly safe as long as he is completely unconcerned about his readiness, but maintains a consistent trust in mine. Parentheses. Errors of this kind produce some very erratic behavior, which usually point up an underlying unwillingness to cooperate. And I was wondering if point up is right there, and I didn't get a chance to look that up, Doug. Note that by inserting the carbon backwards, Bill created a situation in which two copies did not exist. This reflected two levels of confidence lack, one in my readiness to heal, and the other in his own willingness to give, close parenthesis. These errors inevitably introduce inefficiency into the miracle worker's behavior and temporarily disrupt his miracle-mindedness. We might also make very similar comments about your own hesitation about dictating at all. This is a larger error only because it results in greater inefficiency. If you don't say anything, nobody can use it, including me. We have established that for all corrective processes, the first step is known that this is fear. The first step is know that this is fear. Unless fear had entered, the corrective procedure would never have become necessary. If your miracle working propensities are not working, it is always because fear has intruded on your right-mindedness and has literally upset it. in parentheses, i.e., turned it upside down, close parenthesis. Doug.
Well, Carmen typed huge here on the first couple of lines, and I agree. And it's a very, 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 very interesting comment we read here. The healer who relies on his own readiness is endangering his understanding. He is perfectly safe as long as he is completely unconcerned about his readiness, but maintains a consistent trust in mind. Okay. Now, readiness, ready to listen, willingness to learn, and readiness to do, are frequently emphasized, this notion of readiness. Yet, it's not my own readiness on which I depend. It's Jesus' readiness. And when I make that error of trusting in my own readiness, or thinking I need that readiness to be available to Jesus, it produces erratic behavior. And Jesus then gives Bill and Helen apples from their own presumably recent experience. Bill put the carbon paper in backwards by mistake. And that reflected, he's saying, that little mistake reflected two levels of confidence lack. One in my readiness to heal, and the other in his own willingness to give. So the emphasis here is being shifted from readiness to willingness. I have to be willing. The readiness, Jesus will take care of. And then another example with Helen being reluctant to dictate, presumably from the notes dictating to Bill so he could type them up. And we have established that for all corrective processes, the first step is know that this is fear. And this has been mentioned numerous times before, and it will be mentioned many more again before the course is finished. The first step to the corrective process, or the atonement, or the undoing, is to recognize that this is fear. That anything going wrong is basically stems in some kind of fear. And unless fear had entered, the corrective procedure would have been unnecessary. So, if your miracle-working propensities are not working, it is always because fear has intruded on your right-mindedness and literally upset it, or turned it upside down. So you're in a state of wrong-mindedness. And the exit is the little willingness. Willingness. Through which the Holy Spirit and Jesus can work miracles through you. Almost no matter how screwed up you are, if you are willing to trust in Jesus' readiness, then your own readiness is not important. That is a very, very, very interesting concept. Deborah, this is, we're now down at T2C17.
Okay, can more be said about that? Carmen has on the board here, Doug, isn't that bit about the carbon paper about Helen and Bill fighting over who got which copy of the typing, i.e. ego-based fear? And Jack writes, yes, Carmen, can that be expanded on? Because I was very curious when I was reading it what was going on there. Here's the mic.
Well, I don't know exactly what was going on there, but I'm visualizing the story that Bill tells about Helen reading or dictating from her notebooks to him as he typed up the a transcript of the notes. And he made two copies. That was his habit. He used to, in those days, that's how it was done with carbon paper. You put a piece of carbon paper between two sheets of paper, put it in your typewriter, type away. In the end, you've got two copies. So that was presumably in case one got lost or damaged, or they would have one that they could do handwritten markup on without, and yet still have another one to refer to. I'm guessing. In the end, Bill also made photocopies. There's a reference to him having made 12 copies of that, of which unfortunately none has survived, or at least none has become available. That's what I'm thinking there. So he's makes a mistake, a simple clerical error, you might say, puts the carbon paper in backwards. And the result of that would be that the one sheet of paper would have typed on the front of it, everything just right, and on the back of it, there would be a mirror image, but the second piece of paper would be blank. So there wouldn't be a second copy. So, I was commenting on her earlier script. Okay. Carmen has her hand up. I see there. So, I'm going to stop here. And Deb says, Carmen, take the mic. Here you go.
Okay, this is, I'm going to do this real quick because this is, it was pivotal when I read that to understanding what Jesus was talking about, Bill's behavior with the carbon paper being based in fear. I don't know where I got this, but I either heard somebody talking about it or I read it somewhere that when in the early part of the dictation especially, there was like a power struggle going on between Helen and Bill over who would get which of the two copies of the original typing. And apparently it was... is the third copy, if you're old enough like I am to remember how carbon copies work. The first carbon copy is clearer, decidedly clearer than the third carbon copy. It's usually very blurry. And I believe the problem was that they were safeguarding the original copies in a drawer somewhere. And the two of them were, dispensing with the carbon copies to each other. And they were fighting over who was going to get it. And I think, you know, there's a lot of comments about how Bill was passive-aggressive, that he didn't fight with Helen, but he would, like, sabotage things. And what Jesus is saying is that the carbon paper incident wasn't really an accident, that it was a subconscious kind of Freudian slip, that it was his way of, kind of getting back at Helen over this dispute. But this comment, know first this is fear, that's what I was relating to, that the whole struggle for power between these two, as exemplified in this crazy little tiny incident, it's always based on fear. And it helped me to understand it because I had heard, read, encountered that concept about the fight over the carbon copies at some point, and it might be, it's just a little tidbit that helped explain it to me, and it's so obscure if you don't have information like that. What in the world is Jesus talking about? So I just wanted to share that with you. It might be something you would let a researcher look into to see if you can explain that for people better.
Well, thank you, Carmen. Yeah, that would make perfect sense, that he would be making two carbon copies. And yes, the first carbon copy would be better quality than the second. And so who gets which? And somehow or other, that decision has to be made. And they didn't. It's from, if your story is true, and it certainly sounds to me perfectly plausible. I hadn't heard that particular story before. But I see no doubt, knowing how Helen and Bill had some issues, that they didn't find a very good way of resolving that question. And Bill had a certain resentment or grievance, or which is always fear-based, and resulted in a Freudian slip. Unconscious, not deliberate, act that ended up sabotaging the whole enterprise. Okay, so this brings us to, well, that last line on T2C16, I'm going to read again because it is so crucial to this whole discussion. If your miracle working propensities are not working, it is always because fear has intruded on your right-mindedness and it's literally upset it, i.e. turned it upside down. Which takes us to that lesson in the workbook. I am not upset for the reason I think I am upset. Fear has intruded on my right-mindedness, and that is why I'm upset. I think it was my brother's misbehavior, but no, it was my fear that has upset me. And when upset or upside down, we're not in right-mindedness, and miracle working propensities aren't working. Okay, this brings us to T2C17. And Deborah, I'm going to hand you back the mic.
All forms of not right-mindedness are the result of refusal to accept the atonement for yourself. If the miracle worker does accept it, he places himself in the position to recognize that those who need to be healed are simply those who have not done so. The reason why you felt the vast radiation range of your own inner illumination is because you were aware that your right-mindedness is healing. The sole responsibility of the miracle worker is to accept atonement himself. This means that he knows that mind is the only creative level and that its errors are healed by the atonement. Once he accepts this, his mind can only heal. By denying his mind any destructive potential and reinstating its pure constructive powers, he has placed himself in a position where he can undo the level confusion of others. I want to make sure I read that right. By denying his mind any destructive potential and reinstating its pure constructive powers, he has placed himself in a position where he can undo the level confusion of others. The message which he then gives to others is the truth that their minds are really similarly constructive and that their own miscreations cannot hurt them. By affirming this, the miracle worker releases the mind over evaluating its own learning device, in parentheses the body, and restores the mind to its true position as the learner. It should be emphasized that the body does not learn any more than it creates. As a learning device, it merely follows the learner. But if it is falsely endowed with self-initiative, it becomes a serious obstruction to learning it should facilitate. I'll read that last line again. As a learning device, it merely follows the learner, but if it is falsely endowed with self-initiative, it becomes a serious obstruction to the learning it should facilitate. Doug.
Okay. We're restating, again, for emphasis, a point that Jesus has made several times in this segment, that the body does not learn any more than it creates. It's simply a neutral learning device. And it should be reemphasized, yes, that the body does not learn any more than it creates. It should be reemphasized, so let us reemphasize, the body does not learn any more than it creates. As a learning device, it merely follows the learner, the mind. But if it is falsely endowed with self-initiative, it becomes a serious obstruction to the learning it should facilitate. So that error of belief that the body can learn or that the body can create is a serious obstruction to the very purpose of the body, which is as a learning device for the mind. And that error, that mistake, that illusion, that misperception, that misbelief, that false creation of the mind that endows the body with the creative power is essentially deprives the body of its proper function as a teaching device. All right. This brings us to T2C18. Deborah.
Only the mind is capable of illumination. The soul is already illuminated, and the body in itself is too dense. The mind, however, can bring its own illumination to the body by recognizing that density is the opposite of intelligence and therefore unamendable to independent learning. It is, however, easily brought into alignment with a mind which has learned to look beyond density toward light. Corrective learning always begins with awakening the spiritual eye and turning away from belief in physical sight. The reason this entails fear is because man is afraid of what his spiritual eye will see, which is why he closed it in the first place. We said before that the spiritual eye cannot see error and is capable only of looking beyond it to the defilement. There is no doubt that the spiritual eye does produce extreme discomfort by what it sees. The thing that man forgets is that the discomfort is not the final outcome of its perception. When the spiritual eye is permitted to look upon the defilement of the altar, it also looks immediately toward atonement. Nothing which the spiritual eye perceives can induce fear. Everything that results from accurate spiritual awareness merely is channelized toward correction. Discomfort is aroused only to bring the need to correct forcibly into awareness. Discomfort is aroused only to bring the need to correct forcibly into awareness. Doug.
Wow, there is so much here. We could talk about these two paragraphs all day. I'm going to point out the first two lines of T2C18. Only the mind is capable of illumination. The soul is already illuminated, and the body itself is too dense. Now, we have here three levels, in essence. Body, mind, and soul. Now, the word ego hasn't yet shown up in the course, and won't until chapter 3. And egocentricity and ego defenses have been mentioned, but the ego itself hasn't been. And the word mind here, in some senses, comes pretty close to the concept of ego. Because later, and I think it's in chapter 4, Jesus says almost the same thing, that the soul cannot learn because it already knows everything. Only the ego must be taught. The ego, the mind, these two are almost used interchangeably at times. And so what is being taught here is that in between mind, ego, consciousness, who I think I am, and the content of the ego thought, and the ego thought would be anything with which one could complete the sentence, I am. Anything I believe I am would be the contents of my ego. And if we replace, for instance, I am a body with I am a soul, if we can replace the belief that I am a body with the belief that I am a soul, the mind then knows the truth and can bring illumination to the body. It's in right-mindedness, and you might even call that a healed ego, or a healed mind. The two concepts really aren't totally different, I don't think, in the way that Jesus is using it. Now, in the second paragraph, T2C19, corrective learning always begins with awakening the spiritual eye, or our organ of spiritual perception. Our capacity to perceive spiritually is asleep, so it needs to be awakened. and turning away from the belief in physical sight or the belief in the truth of physical sight. We're not being told to disbelieve that there is physical sight, but we're being told to transfer our trust from our physical eye to our spiritual eye, faith, belief. And this can entail fear. And the reason it entails fear is because man is afraid of what his spiritual eye will see, which is why he closed it in the first place. The ostrich syndrome. If I don't like what I see, I will deny that it's there. I'll close my eyes, I'll put my head in the sand, I'll pretend it's not happening. And it was the defilement of the altar, or the distortions and fallacies that the spiritual eye saw, that led to the mind being fearful and closing the spiritual eye so that those falsehoods would be denied and defended. We said before that the spiritual eye cannot see error and is capable only of looking beyond it to the defense of atonement. It cannot see error, but it can recognize the defilement, that there's not rightness, you might say. There's no doubt that the spiritual eye does produce extreme discomfort by what it sees. The thing that man forgets is that the discomfort is not the final outcome of its perception. When the spiritual eye is permitted to look upon the defilement of the altar, it also looks immediately towards the atonement or the undoing. So the spiritual eye sees the need for undoing. It does not focus on the errors. So nothing which the spiritual eye perceives can appear when correctly perceived, i.e. looking towards the atonement. Everything that results from accurate spiritual awareness merely is channelized towards correction. And then, this amazing line, discomfort is aroused only to bring the need to correct forcibly into awareness. So that's what discomfort is for. It makes us aware, going back to the origins of the Course, it was discomfort with an acrimonious professional meeting that led Bill to say to Helen, there must be a better way. In other words, I'm very uncomfortable with what we just experienced. There must be a better way. In other words, his discomfort was aroused and brought about his awareness of the need for correction. And that's what discomfort is for, to bring the need for correction forcibly into awareness. And then the correction being prescribed is the atonement or the undoing, which requires the capacity for spiritual vision or spiritual perception, the spiritual eye, to be awakened. Not to focus on mistakes, but to focus on their undoing or the atonement. Okay, and there's a whole lot on the board here which I haven't read. And I'm going to drop the mic here and look on that. If anybody wants to make a comment, by all means do so. I see we have 20 minutes left, so there is time for a discussion here. And I'm going to drop the mic and have a look at the board. Deb, here you go.
Okay, I wanted to ask a question here. Back in T2C16, it says, the first step is know that this is fear. Does Jesus in this go through a step-by-step process? So it was that this is to establish that for all corrective processes, then we start with that first step to identify there's fear here, that this is fear, and then it's a carry-on. Do you know if it's actually says in here step, next step? Here you go, Doug.
Yeah, that question crossed my mind some weeks ago. And I did a search to see if there was, in fact, a step-by-step process being, you know, sort of buried in the text there, like that we could itemize, step one, step two, step three, etc. The closest I could come to is that this is a This is a bit of a preview of what we're going to get to in chapter 30 with the seven rules for decision, where actually the whole step-by-step process is itemized. And when we can recognize it's fear, then the second step of looking towards the atonement, I suppose by implication, is possible. Until we know it's fear, we're going to think that our discomfort comes from something else. And we won't, there, you know, we'll think in the context of this discussion that it's because I have a sore foot. Well, I have a sore foot because I'm afraid. All right. At some level, it's fear that is the cause. And that's got to have come from a false belief. And that needs undoing. And that's the atonement. And through this, by awakening the spiritual eye, the solution comes. But other than that, it's a great question about step one, step two, step. And I don't know beyond that approximate parallel with what's in chapter 30. And I haven't read the board yet because I've been looking at that question. All right. Deborah, here you go. We're at the end of T2C19, and maybe I'll just stop here and read aloud what's on the board. Miscreations cannot hurt. Amazing stuff, writes Lee. Jackson writes, I would not say anyone can undo the level of confusion of others. However, I would say the right-minded miracles workers can facilitate a process whereby a willing patient can himself undo his wrong-minded thinking. Yeah, I think that that's actually how I understand that. It's not, I mean, when we look at the examples in Jesus' life from the New Testament, we see that the effect he had on many people was to restore their right-mindedness. Not so much that he did it, but they saw in him something that awakened their own spiritual eye and made them more trustful of the possibility of healing or right-mindedness. He set an example which shifted the way they were thinking, I believe. And the healer is always the mind of the patient. The healer, yeah, Jackson writes there, the receptivity to healing is necessary. The decision to be well precedes getting well. And the decision to be well is what, when you make that decision, you get well. The brain or the Carmen writes, or that the brain or intellect forces a limitation on our learning. Lee writes, Doug, here is the answer to why we are not seeing miracles. We are afraid of what we will see. Guilt. The answer to why we're not seeing miracles was in 16, if your miracle working propensities are not working, it is always because fear is intruded into your right mindedness. Fear of what? Fear of guilt. That would be very often exactly what the fear is. And that also leads into 19. Why we closed our spiritual eye in the first place, because we were afraid of what we were going to see. The guilt. The belief in guilt. Jackson writes, pain is the touchstone to spiritual awakening. Very often that's true. Pain is the gift of an opening for trans change. pain tells us there's something wrong. And if it weren't for discomfort, we wouldn't, the fact that there's something wrong would not be forcibly brought to our attention. Jackson goes on, all true perception contains appreciation, open-mindedness, and compassion, no matter what form it appears to take on. Absolutely. Nothing so blinding as perception of form, for sight of form means understanding has been obscured. Yes, and that would be if we, the belief in physical sight as the only reality, the perception of the form that physical sight can bring, if we think that's all that's true, then our spiritual eye is closed. We must shift our perception from a focus on mistakes, our own and those of others, to a focus on the underlying love and innocence that is our true nature. Okay, this is probably, Del writes, this is probably how most of us found ACIM. There must be a better way. Carmen writes, exactly. And Adele writes, you will have peace when peace is all you want. That reminds me of a line later in the course, which I can't quite pull out of my memory right now. But yeah, what, I mean, you will have peace when peace is all you want. In chapter 21, we're told projection makes perception. And to paraphrase, if you project love, what you're going to see is a loving world. If you project fear, what you're going to see is a fearful world. And because you want to. That, you know, no experience comes to any son of God except by his own decision. Not necessarily a conscious decision, but unconsciously, like Bill with his carbon paper, he didn't consciously make it bad. Unconsciously, he wanted things to screw up, so they did. And yeah. If you will have peace when peace is all you want, you will have whatever you want. And what you have must be what you wanted. And if you don't like it, if it's uncomfortable, then that leads to the line in 19, discomfort is aroused only to bring the need for correction forcibly into awareness. Yeah. Okay, we now have 10 minutes left, and if anyone wants to make a comment at this point, feel free to do so. So we're going to have to stop pretty soon, but we could get at least one more paragraph in here. Yeah, we're at T2C20 now. Okay, here's the mic tip.
Where's my marker? I got it. What the physical eye sees is not corrective, nor can it be corrected by any device which can be physically seen. As long as a man believes in what his physical sight tells him, all his corrective behavior will be misdirected. The reason why the real vision is obscured is because man cannot endure to see his own defiled altar. But since the altar has been defiled, this fact becomes doubly dangerous unless it is perceived. This perception is totally non-threatening because of the atonement. The fear of healing arises in the end from an unwillingness to accept the unequivocal fact that healing is necessary. The fear arises because of the necessary willingness to look at what man has done to himself. Healing was an ability which was lent to man after the separation, which it was completely unnecessary. Like all aspects of the space-time belief, healing ability is temporary. However, as long as time persists, healing remains among the stronger human protections. This is because healing always rests on charity, and charity is a way of perceiving the true perfection of another, even if he cannot perceive it himself. Most of the loftier concepts of which man is capable now are time-dependent. Charity is really a weaker reflection of a much more powerful love encompassment, which is far beyond any form of charity that man can conceive of as yet. Charity is essential to right-mindedness in the limited sense to which right-mindedness can now be attained. Charity is a way of looking at another as if he had already gone far beyond his actual accomplishment in time. Since his own thinking is faulty, he cannot see the atonement himself, or he would have no need for charity at all. The charity which is accorded him is both acknowledgement that he is weak and a recognition that he could be stronger. The way in which both of these beliefs are stated clearly implies their dependence on time, making it quite apparent that charity lies within the framework of human limitations, though toward the higher levels. Doug.
This is so fantastic, this line, these two paragraphs, and it reflects back to what Jackson was typing. We must shift our perception from a focus on mistakes, our own and those of others, to a focus on the underlying love and innocence that is our true nature. And this reminds me of the basic psychological theory of ego, as Freud initially coined the term and the concept. And we think we are what we're told we are, as we're born and grow up. And I think everybody is aware that a stern and critical parent who always says, you're a bad boy, you're a bad boy, you're a bad boy, and the kid feels he can't do anything right, and never gets affirmation from his parents, will very frequently believe he's bad and be bad as he understands it. And the roots of chronic criminality often lie in just such things, these false beliefs. Now, we're being told in these two paragraphs, and Jackson was pointing this out before, that when we look at someone with charity and see beyond the error to the perfection, what we're telling the person is, you are perfect in reality. And we're showing that to them in our genuine charity or love. We're seeing the Holy Son of God instead of the mistake. And as we see that and communicate that to the person and reflect behavior towards the person, that person starts to see himself through our eyes. We always see each other through each other's eyes. Every time we communicate, we are sending messages about who we think you are, who I think you are. You'll know how I think you are by what I say to you. And if what you're hearing is true of your higher self, of your real self, of your true perfection, you will see that. And in seeing it reflected in my communications to you, you can more ably recognize it in yourself. And the contrary is also true. If all I see is nitpicking, critical, you're no good, then that's all you're going to see from me. And it will tend to reinforce that or trigger denial and fear. So how we treat each other, how we see each other, is in itself potentially enormously healing. If we focus on the truth of the ultimate perfection and see that behind, through the mistakes and the defilement of the altar, we help not only ourselves see the truth, we help all those with whom we are in communication see the truth, and that in itself is inherently healthy. Because, or healing, because it is a step towards right-mindedness. It encourages the recognition of truth. And We now have 3 minutes left. So, wow, this has been one amazing afternoon. These 2 hours go so quickly. We've got through 21 paragraphs in 2 hours. 21 of the most amazing paragraphs in the course, which lay out some of the fundamental concepts that are going to be elaborated and developed in subsequent chapters. Thank you everyone for being here. Thank you everyone who has offered contributions on the board and on the mic. Your participation is so much appreciated. And I just love being with you guys on these Sunday afternoons. It's such a thrill. And on that note, I'm going to hand the mic to Deborah for her goodbyes. God bless you.
Doug, we still have 2 minutes in this paragraph 22. Is so small that the next section starts, fear as lack of love. Shan't I read that? I think it's a good idea. Okay, I'm going to go ahead. We said before, twice in fact, that only revelation transcends time. The miracle, as an expression of true human charity, can only shorten it at best. It must be understood, however, that whenever a man offers a miracle to another, he is shortening the suffering of both. This introduces a correction into the record, which corrects retroactively as well as progressively. And with reading that little paragraph, I want to add in that I have seen that in my mind, or my spiritual eye. I've seen that where it corrects retroactively, where everything just zips through and corrects all the misperception that is based even on something from way back, a misperception or misbelief, that false creation, that miscreation. It just zips through and corrects, and that was a pretty fascinating thing to watch. So thanks, everybody, and this was wonderful. It's really got my mind going here. This is to continue, so see you again hopefully next week. Bye.